This is Nathan Schwartz Salant, 18th of November, 1989, Alchemy, Borderline States, Tape 2 of 3.
Oh, yes, I told her. Yes, of course. But I acknowledged that to her. I did not just keep that to myself. I acknowledged that her perceptions were accurate. But I acknowledged it in a containing way. I acknowledged it in a way where she could hear that this was coming from a sector in me that I had to recognize existed, but that her perception was right. Absolutely. The bane of any analysis like this would be if those levels ever got split, if that archetypal and personal ever were split. It would show up, for example, with if I amplified things, if I talked about the sun lover myth and never brought it back to me, and never brought it back to the personal interaction. You know, that we don't want. And these states are always intertwined. Yes? Nice. Really? That's interesting. Well, I guess when we're nice, we got to be careful, huh? Yeah. Yes. Two ways. You're with a borderline patient. The patient is saying to you, the patient is having... Two ways. You're with a borderline patient. The patient is saying to you, the patient is having certain behaviors. All right? You're with a male patient. This patient is talking to you about... Being driven up at between 10 and 2 o'clock every night of his life to call a prostitute. He can't stop calling a prostitute. He calls a prostitute to get into very bizarre behavior. You're called upon, you hear this story. How do you hear it? Do you hear this story through what organ of perception? If you hear it with empathy, all right. Judgment, all right. All that will be flying through the air. If you hear it through the eyes of your own psyche as it's enlivened by your own sun lover level, you can be a woman and feel the goddess in that level with the sun and feel the affects that that goddess has. You can be a man and feel the sun overwhelmed, and know that there, but for very slight differences, there go I. You see? And then when you speak to that person, then you contact. You know how you contact? You contact because your tone of voice changes. You contact because you talk in a different cadence. You contact because you talk in a different rhythm. You see, everything that's not easily discussed and written about, but you change, and things change them. Well, our best hope is to realize that our borderline complexes are not just negative things, but carry within them aspects that the collective, that our collective psyche has rejected, carry within them primarily the capacity for vision, capacity for imaginal sight, and also carry within them our worst evil, our worst darkness. So in a sense, our borderline sector is our link to the pulse of the whole collective psyche. It's our link to to the cutting edge of how we have to grow. If you connect to your borderline parts, you will connect to violent ruthlessness. You will connect to parts of yourself in which you are terrified by abandonment and have all kinds of compensatory devices to avoid it. You know, you will connect to parts of yourself in which you dissociate easily and which you feel all kinds of perverse behavior to bind yourself. You'll connect to that whole underside of yourself, and in so doing, you connect to humanity. To humanity. You cease to become naive. You cease to become judgmental. You cease to become power-driven. So in a very strange way, the complex cures the complex. The more we connect to that side in ourselves, the more we're aware of how that madness now runs the world. That's a crucial thing that these sides of ourselves give us. The more we connect to that side of ourselves, the more we become very, very, very realistic and less naive about things. We know that evil really exists. We know that people behave in extremely crazy ways. In other words, what we can get out of it is reality. And there's no other way to get that reality except by meeting those levels in yourself, because those are the levels that are running this world. Those levels of absolute denial, reality distortion, that would think nothing about killing an environment, that would pollute an environment and not care, that is borderline. But see, only by knowing those levels within yourself are you going to be able to understand the malevolence in those kind of acts, for example, towards the environment, rather than see them as political or economic or mistakes. In other words, in dealing with those levels within yourself, you really have a chance to open to a level of consciousness of how things are. And also to levels of intense passion. In those states, there have been is where all of our passion, to a large degree, has been dumped and split off. That's why the so-called borderline person is filled with such perversity. But in fact, those are the energies that the ancients called Dionysus. It's in that so-called borderline state that one meets, in fact, what's been tossed out by humanity. It's like, you know, in Brazil, there's a tribe called the Tucano Indians. And they believe that all evil goes to the Milky Way. And it's all stored there as dark boga. They call boga the energy that runs through the whole universe. And there's negative, evil, dark boga that gets stored in the Milky Way, all the dark evil of everything. Yet it's there where the shaman goes in a mystical ascent for healing purposes. That's where the shaman goes, to the Milky Way. You see? And it's that kind of mystery. You know, one opens up, in other words, to all that's been repressed, split off in so many different dimensions that in a strange way it's a door. It's one of our best doors to growth. But it's never anything that we conquer. You see, it's something that we only learn to live with. It's like if someone has a narcissistic character disorder, and that character disorder becomes healed, more or less. It doesn't vanish. It becomes the shadow of the new personality. It's always there to erupt at any time. So if that answers you, I mean, that's what is there for us if we wish to go there. The techniques have to do with analysis. This is not something to do alone. You will never do that alone. Yes. Right. See, it depends what you mean by face it. Did Thomas Wolfe face it? Thomas Wolfe did not face it, but Thomas Wolfe was a severe borderline personality who wrote about it and was a great author. But we have two editors who have written books about Thomas Wolfe because he dumped his pages on their desk and they put order into it. It's a question of what you mean by connecting to it. I think the author, if it's a Dostoevsky, if it's a Wolfe, you know, if it's a Lawrence, you know, certainly can contact those levels. But I answered you in terms of the motif of integration of personality. And in that sense, although of course there's never a never, just to make the point though, I would still say that it needs another person. If there's going to be an integration of those levels. If one's, one can get into these through a way of art, but not integrate them. One can try to transcend them, so to speak, through various meditations and not integrate them. See? But if you're talking about getting to know this devil within you, how it's always lurking and always ready to distort your relationships and your and create lies within the fabric of your own being. My experience is that's an issue that goes on between people. Yeah. Does the borderline have a different relationship, different from what do you mean? Like, what do you have in mind? Like, to the contrasexual component? In other words, the question is, does a borderline man have any particular feature of relationship to his inner feminine side, or the borderline woman, any particular feature of relation to the inner male side? The only difference, you might say, that one will usually find is that the contrasexual components will often be in a powerfully archetypal form. In a man, a male borderline personality, often the feminine side is a wild devouring goddess. In a woman, you know, borderline personality, there's the male side will often have a very, very demonic, powerful Bluebeard kind of effect in its demonic, captivating, possessing quality. It's a difference in that sense, is my experience, that the archetypal power has been less personalized, so there's less of a covering of it. So, you know, and consequently, it has more of a rush and more of a rawness of affect and power. The flip side of the coin, of course, is more creativity is open. More possibility to meet those powers. Yes. Well, in talking about, everyone has a shadow. What I'm saying is in talking about a borderline part, I'm talking about a part of all of us in which we have borderline features. And you could call that your shadow if you want. It could describe your shadow part. Except if you talk about that, you know, it's rather better to talk about it as a whole, like an inner complex, a myth that could have all kinds of parts in it. A whole story in which you are, so to speak, borderline. Terrified of abandonment. Tendency to act in self-destructive ways. Tendency to, you know, distort, tendency to have a very great loss of identity intense identity diffusion, etc. All borderline features, you see. You know, so a whole array of behavior. It's more like a system of behaviors and energies that's normally split off. Yes? DSM-3 is okay, but as far as it goes, for me, actually DSM-3R revised is better, but one of the cardinal features of the borderline personality, this is of course unheard of for any kind of DSM-3 kind of approach, as well as for the borderline sector in anyone, is it represents a place where vision has been denied. Where vision has been denied. And where the effects of the denial of vision, of perception, of imaginal sight, are felt in a horrendous way. In other words, the person has stopped seeing things as they are. Because they were too horrible, how things really were too horrible to see. And it's the splitting of that sight, which you then meet again, often in the analysis of a borderline personality in terms of, well, the clinical psychoanalytic jargon is scanning, where one feels some background process scanning you. I make far more of that than they do. For me, that's a crucial central factor which represents a split-off, caricatured form of what could be true perception. Perception that could see into the unconscious, that sees mother as she really was, that sees father as he really was. That kind of sight that sees through the double bind, that sees the double binding qualities, was too horrible to maintain for the child and had to be split off. So I don't mind all the DSM-3 stuff. I think there's better ways if you want to, run down a list of characteristics. There's better than DSM-3. You know, it's all right. But I think this, the one that all of them leave out, I mean, Kleinians have better groupings. You know, the one that they all leave out has to do with vision, has to do with perception. Yes. Say that again. Oh, well, no, not really. You see, what one's really talking about, if you talk about a borderline sector in you, or you talk about a borderline personality, is more of a vertical split. It's more like there's two of you. You see, when you're talking about the inferior function, you're talking about more of a horizontal split. You're talking about something that's going, you know, this way. You know, in this, we're talking about splitting that goes this way. Left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. Yes. And I talk about the borderline instead of the borderline person. Yeah, I think it can have an object. I think it can have an object significance, like a structure. And of course, if that structure then takes over a person, then it becomes an adjective. Then it's a borderline personality. You know, but I think one can talk about a borderline structure, and in that case, talk about the borderline. I don't think it has to become an adjective until you're talking about a person who is dominated by those features. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I like to think about it more as a phenomenology of a sector that can be larger or smaller depending on the person. Yes. Within what? Is validating the patient's perceptions typical of Jungian analysis? Well, it depends. I think it's a is it typical of the way Jungian analysis is done? No. Is it typical of the way any analysis is done? No. Is it inherent in Jung's attitude and spirit towards the psyche? Yes. If a patient has a dream about you, Jung would always insist on seeing where it's right. So once you've gone that far, once you've gone so far as to take the patient's psychic products as having a potential degree of truth, you've gone, you know, already the camel's in the tent. You know, then why not take the patient's fantasies, the patient's complaints, you know, everything as carrying a potential seed of truth and looking for it, looking for where the person is right rather than where they're wrong. It certainly is within the spirit of Jung, absolutely. Not that he did it in his actual work. I do it. I don't think it's necessarily so popular. People worry about it. They worry that you're going to inflate, you know, the delusional sectors of people. It's not true. It's not true. Certainly you're not going to mirror the validity of the perceptions of someone, you know, in a full-blown paranoid episode. I'm not talking about psychotic people. I'm not talking about people who have lost reality contact. I'm talking about dealing with people who have maintained reality contact but have aspects of them that distort that at times. And I'm saying it's a good thing to risk really listening to the truth of the perception. It's a little bit like along the lines of what, you know, Robert Langs does, you know, where, you know, we'll take the hidden communications from what the patient says as, you know, representative of truth about the analyst. That's the same thing. Only I'm saying that one often, you know, has to go a little further and not just hear the derivatives, so to speak, but actually penetrate the process more imaginally, actively. But in either case, one is talking about the patient's speech, perceptions, whatever, as having validity. So I say that's the first line of approach. If distortions have to be found, they'll come in. But a patient will often, you see, intentionally, unconsciously, intentionally distort his or her own perceptions in order not to be vulnerable, not to risk having power. You understand? If you have true perception, if you have the strength, as an extreme example of vision, of mystical vision as an extreme, but take it on a lower level, if you have the strength of clear perception, the terror then arises that if I'm that strong, I'll be abandoned. If I see clearly, nobody will want to be with me. So the patient often will intentionally distort, unconsciously distort those perceptions, and it's very easy then to deal with distortion rather than deal with truth. Much better to realize the devil has a golden hair, you know, than just see the devil. Pull out the golden hair, then deal with the devil. Yes.
Thank you.
Well, the thing I think to remember is that it happens often in a very unconscious way, in a very subtle and unconscious way. The drive for power, for example, say take someone who is gripped by a demonic power mad fiend like Bluebeard. That very person, on the surface, may be a nice guy, you know, or a woman may be very nice. Yet strangely, people with them are not thriving. Strangely, people seem tied by them and confined by them and seem to need them in order to grow and don't seem to be getting out on their own and growing. Yet they're generous. They're giving. You know, they're wonderful. Give you the shirt off their back. Spend hours with you. And yet something demonic is happening. Something is happening where the person's soul is trapped. Now, on the other side of the coin, in a person who, say, suffers from a so-called full-blown borderline personality disorder and is gripped by that kind of a thing, what will happen is it'll get acted out. It'll be impossible not to actually act it out. There will be all kinds of perverse ritual, you know? The person may buy a slave. The person may hire someone to act out such rituals with him or with her. But those powerful contents of psyche, these archetypal powers, you see overwhelm ego. And then if a person is not manifestly, say, borderline, but has sufficient narcissistic control and defenses, then they will be split off and will operate in an extremely insidious way in the unconscious. If the person is more borderline and has more porosity in structure, so does not have defenses, then they'll come in and they will act out in violent ways. Okay? Yes, one more. Facilitate what? Is there any way to work more directly with the subtle body to facilitate the therapeutic process? Oh, absolutely. I give lots of examples of that in my book on the borderline personality. Absolutely. In fact, I think that's where some of the greatest movement happens. What I tried to do in this case, in a dumb, premature way, was interact in a subtle body field. But these fields are tricky. That's why in alchemy they're ruled by Mercurius, who is both God and the devil. In this case, it turned out to be a trickster-like force that I engaged and got tricked by. But in other situations, not at all. There's plenty of case material in that book, if you're so interested, that'll, you know, exactly address your question of engaging a subtle body field, which then does have definite healing potential, has the potential to integrate states that have been split off for ages. It's like a magnet. It has a very high healing potential. Yet it all depends how you enter it, not in a trance-like way. For example, I have a whole chapter on projective identification and ways of using projective identification to enter that field. There's a lot to say about that, but the answer is yes. So, thank you again.
Saturday. This begins Dr. Nathan Schwartz-Salant's seminar on November 18th, 1989.
Okay. Is that a little better? Okay. Are there any issues hanging from this morning that you can talk about? Or shall I just go on?
I had one thing I wanted to talk about. I was curious about it, around what you're talking about, when you sacrifice, you go out knowing, or...
Yes.
I've always thought of that as sort of an area of taboo. It's the experience I have when I start to fall into that embodied sort of state. I wonder if you could speak to that.
Well,
the reluctance to go into that.
That's interesting, yes.
It seems like it's partly reluctance to give up knowing or ego, but also reluctance to go into that.
Yes, chaos. Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. I need it a tiny bit lower on the amplification, or I'm going to leave. Okay, see how that is, and tell me if you can't hear. I think the experience I have with that is that the reluctance to give up the interpretation, the reluctance to give up the knowing, is because in the act of giving it up, one comes closer to incestuous material. You come closer to contacting in a way that has an incestuous feel to it, meaning you enter an arena of energies that you've been conditioned to reject from earliest times. Yes, that's why the taboo feeling. That's why the energies that alchemy engaged to a large extent were precisely those energies. It's out of those rejected energies, those energies of taboo, that the stone, so to speak, the central focus of alchemical thought is created. That along with spiritual understanding. So it's an intentional act of entering those energies that's involved.
When I think of incest, I think of abuse and intimacy, and I'm not sure if you're using it that way or if you're just using the intimacy.
I'm using it in the following way. I'm using it as a conscious awareness of those energies that have always been used as an abuse of intimacy. When a father abuses his daughter incestuously, he need not do it physically. He can do it through his lack of containment of his own shadow qualities. It's rather the awareness of those energies and the capacity to objectify their existence without acting on them or getting off on them. That's the critical issue. You see, the problem is those energies are exceptionally enlivening. Everybody has dead spots. Analysts want to be enlivened by their patients. Patients want to be enlivened. Part of the way of conceiving of the borderline psyche, it's a place where the self is dead, listless, not alive. So that's why, for example, in borderline personalities, there's so much perversity, so to speak, as an attempt to enliven the dead self. So you have all this potential of abuse, but I mean it in terms of a focusing on those energies without an acting. And the focusing need not be verbalized. There are many, many people, especially incest victims, for whom it is, again, a violation to verbalize it. Yeah?
Is that what you mean then by the vision, that you can see?
Yes. 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 And when we go through the second...
Is that what was meant by the vision I was talking about, that one can see it without necessarily acting or even saying? And when I go through this other text I was talking to you about, Isis to her son Horus, you'll see a wonderful thing about these incest energies. Okay, let's see if we can... Yeah.
Could you agree that, as I understand you're saying, that is the depression. But depression lately has been divided again by some people to grieving and depression. And I was wondering which of those two, or if you agree with...
You said grieving and what? Yes.
Grieving is where you feel a lot of intense emotion.
Yes.
You look the symptoms are the same, but it's quite different.
A very good question. The nigredo for the alchemist is intentionally meant to be that state of mind where there's an active relation to the depression. Hence, a grieving, not merely a being swamped in it as in depression, but an active relationship to it. Furthermore, it's more than depression. The nigredo includes states of mind in which there's absolutely no sense of linking to another person. So it can be close to what Jung calls a schizophrenic dissociation, a state of mind where there's no connection. The nigredo in alchemy is intended to encompass not only states of depression, grieving, for example, grieving for the unions one never had. Much of the grief that has to go on in psychotherapy is not for the loss of what you had, but for the loss of what you never had. It's that kind of grieving that has to go on. But it's broader than that and includes states of madness in the sense of where the self is not functional. And when one meets levels in which boundaries easily disappear and chaotic energies emerge. So it's larger than the state of depression, which is already an object relation. Depression is an object relation. It also enters into, in its other levels, states of mind that are more schizoid, where there's no object. Okay? But in terms of what you talk about as the depressive part, the alchemist would particularly be looking towards an active relatedness to the depression, like a grieving. Hence, there's pictures of the nigredo which will show the alchemist in a ditch meditating for 40 days. An active meditative process. You see, one of the keys here is that when one suffers states of mind like intense absence, intense loss, intense chaos, those states of mind can be readily reflected in terms of early infant issues. And there's no question that they have to be. In other words, they can at one point or another be reflected in terms of the earliest, say, mother-child relation and processes of deep regression in which the analyst is absolutely essential as a containing influence, where the patient's intense hunger is a reflection of the need for connection, where the loss of contact for 4 hours becomes intolerable and leads to temper tantrums. That level of distress has to be engaged at some point. But the alchemical model and the Jungian model would also understand those symptoms of distress as the distress of a self attempting to emerge. Not only the distress that the ego is feeling as a re-experience of awful early states, but aspects of process of a new emerging self. Hence, you can read St. John of the Cross, you can read The Dark Knight, as an example of borderline psychology, if you're so foolish. Or you can read it as it is, as an awareness of the self preparing itself for a new birth, for example, in John, in the ascent to Mount Carmel. But everything that John suffers, the intense states of emptiness, the states of mindlessness, the intense states of depression, even being jailed by his order, or, you know, the social outcast, all of that are states of mind and activities which are common and close to the borderline person. So it's all a question of what angle do you take it from. Do you take it from the point of view of the ego, and in fact the ego as it regresses to early levels? Do you take it from the point of view of archetypal processes? And you can never split the two. One of the great problems, I think, in our Jungian heritage is splitting those into personal and archetypal. Rather, it's always both. And it's not that it's simply a mixture. It's the wrong way to think about it. I like to put it like this. If somebody says to you, are personal and archetypal levels always mixed? The answer is no. If you're asked, are personal and archetypal levels at times separated? The answer is also no. It is neither nor logic. It hangs in paradox. You can't lean on one side or the other, because it attempts to take a mystery that's primarily operative in spaces which are beyond the discursive temporal life of the ego and of space-time. And when you try to pull it into space-time with an either-or, you lose it. So one has to realize one's dealing with qualities of existence that have a paradoxical nature. At times one is in focus, at times another is in focus. So that cana nigredo state, on the one hand, it is the nigredo that the ego suffers as a return to the earliest states of deprivation, but it also is a state that the self suffers on its way to becoming. And the art is never to split the two. Yes?
I'm wondering if you think there's something in offering, I'm thinking specifically of the Emerald Tablet, that refers to something that's not a process and is beyond offering.
That is what?
Beyond offering, beyond process and beyond offering, in terms of like, I'm thinking, okay, there's this great promise, and then at the end it says, then you go through the Odyssey, and it's a great promise. And that sounds more like exorcism to me than actually.
You got it. Please run it through me again. I didn't hear you. Please say it again.
In the Emerald Tablet,
yeah.
It sounds like such a great process. I mean, it sounds like such a great promise. Then we talk about the transmutations.
Right.
Hints of how to go about
that. Right. Yeah. When Jung deals with that, he deals with it beautifully. He says it's incredibly naive.
What?
Yeah. That what you're talking about. You know, that's, you know, that things all come out so wonderfully. Now, were you saying so? What were you talking about, exorcism?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it refers to something. It seems like in within the Emerald Tablet, towards the end, it seems to refer to something that's like beyond process or something that sounds more like exorcism. Like,
yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. There's two traditions that intertwine, among others, in alchemy. One is the Hermetic tradition that you refer to, the so-called Emerald Tablet, as above, so below. The other tradition is the Iranian tradition of Zoroaster. One the tradition of magic, the Zoroastrian, the other the tradition of the Hermetic tradition of so-called the mystical, you know, the mythical Hermes Trismegistus, the tradition of self-knowledge, that in one hand one receives the capacity to be free of the tyranny of fate through self-knowledge and the tyranny of the stars, the other through magical practice. They're different traditions. The one would be more with exorcism, the other with self-knowledge. They both play a role. In other words, there is definitely a role of casting out demons. There definitely is a role of dealing with negative pieces put into you that don't belong to you, that you have to get rid of, as well as transmuting pieces. They go together. Everything inside of you doesn't belong to you and isn't there just to be transmuted. Some of it is there to be left, gotten rid of. Always that combination. So, yeah, one more.
The way that you were talking about the person going back and re-experiencing their early experiences,
mm-hmm.
and someone saying that also this is the self, blind,
right.
kind of born or become.
Right. Right, it's using self in a different way. The self that Winnicott's talking about is a self of psychoanalytic theory, which is still a content of the ego. The self that's trying to be born from the alchemical perspective is the self with a capital S. It's the self that still has a link to its numinous origins. One's dealing with different qualities of self. One's dealing with self not simply as a center of ego and even as a center of psyche, but self as that which connects to the larger realm of the numinosum, which is never linked to psyche. Self that links to spaces and levels of existence and scales of existence that never can be incarnated. Self in a biblical sense rather than self as a nuclear thing that unfolds itself in the process of a lifetime. A different quality of self, connected, mind you, linked, very connected, no doubt, but also different. The doctrine that links the two is the notion of the Son of Man. You know, when Christ says, I am the Son of Man, that's the notion that the self, if one takes Christ as a self symbol, is in fact a result, is in fact linked to the consciousness of man, say the consciousness of the ego. When one says that, talks in terms of the Father instead of the Son as the source, one talks about a source of self outside of ego and further away and having more to do with the transcendent level. In other words, one's talking about, you know, different qualities of self, and it's an important issue. The psychoanalytic concept of self is very different in essentials from what Jung meant by self. They link when it comes to being substantially connected to structures of the ego. They diverge greatly when it comes to connecting to that issue of the numinosum. For Winnicott, the self must engage instinctual processes. For Jung, there can be a coherent self-structure that primarily partakes of mental spiritual processes and then links to instinctual processes.
Go over that one more time.
For Jung, there can be a self-structure that's particularly inherently spiritual and mental in quality, and then links to bodily processes. That runs right smack in the face of most all psychoanalytic tradition, which insists that the ego is a body ego first. This would be a tradition that would insist instead that first there's a mental ego that has to come into the body. A mental ego self state that's linked to a transcendent level. So you see what I mean? There's these very different emphases depending on what kind of energies levels of experience one insists on incorporating into what is meant by self. Am I clear? So, by the way, I tried to talk about that in the first chapter of my book on narcissism. That difference between self in psychoanalytic, in religious and biblical, in Jungian tradition, and the central importance in Jung of the issue of the noumenon, that quality which is the essence of religious experience. That's right. That's right. And saying that, in fact, they have to, in a process, not have to, but often in a deep process, those two levels will get connected. For example, I have a woman now going through a very deep process that's mostly been on a level of intense regression, where her needs for me are extreme. Acting out tends to immediately happen in terms of abuse of food or alcohol if she's away for too long or doesn't have contact with me. The more she's stopped that acting out, the more intense her pain would be, etc., etc., until finally, after many, many months, it was possible for her to gradually begin to realize she cannot move through her process by herself. She desperately needs her link to me, and accepting that vulnerability, the terror it brings, that same woman eventually being able to tell me the intense levels of terror she actually goes through, like sitting at a telephone and staring at a wall for 4 hours, paralyzed, you know, waiting for a call from me. Intense, humiliating levels of truth finally coming out. Finally, a level of truth revealed in her relationship with me, which was too impossible to ever think of talking about before, because now she cannot hide. If she had hidden that from me and didn't really tell me how intense it was, she could keep hiding from me. And once that level started opening up, then that same woman had a dream that she was on a ship that was going in a certain way and she had to get off it. And that she was taking the mass, and she was not in, and she was, there was none of the wafer left for her. And the significance of that had to do with the need to finally incorporate a new spiritual dimension into that process, but without losing the other at the same time. But a change of ship was necessary. A new spiritual attitude based on faith was ready again to have to come into her. That kind of, if that imagery helps, that kind of background dream imagery can point to these kind of shifts too. The worst poison, however, would have been if I in any way attempted to get her to now be on some spiritual journey or to meditate or introvert. And in one iota, take away the importance of my need, you know, the need she has, you know, in that situation, how much she needs. Because the greatest problem is the slippage away from the intense reality of the dependency needs. That's where the devil lurks, in a realm of power, to slip away from that and become instead a fabric of lies that feigns dependency and can misuse the spirit. It's a tricky level. But it's in that way that those personal archetypal realms, I think, can interface in a very, very creative way, not used defensively.
Did you interpret it through her as spiritual?
Yes, it was her interpretation herself. She's a Catholic and knows the Mass quite well. It was her own interpretation. It wasn't mine. Well, at that point, the old thing happened. She began to realize the began to ask the question, what am I doing wrong of herself? What am I doing wrong? Why is it I don't have a spiritual attitude? What's wrong with me? Maybe I should have a spiritual attitude. See, the typical thing that goes on. That's why I read that hymn to you, that Egyptian hymn, that had to do with before, while doing was still in the time of confusion. You know, while doing was still asleep. That's what she needs to hear. I read her the hymn, you know, the Egyptian hymn. So that's always what happens. The devil is always there, ready to grab it.
What happens for you in that process?
What happens? How do you mean that? Say a little more.
It would be interesting to have some insight into how you experience that level of dependency with another.
Well, it's a little bit like having to be an adult. It's just a fact. That's where I have to be. It's a responsibility. I don't experience it at this point in any great numinous way. I don't experience it as any great linking of fate. I don't look to psychics who tell me we've had past lives in Egypt together. I experience it as work. I experience it like a mother who works, who has to tend the infant. I experience it as very basic fact that if I don't feed her properly, which means be in my heart and be connected, she is not going to thrive. I experience it simply as responsibility and fact. Yeah?
I presume you mean by that all the time, not just during the session.
All the time. All the time. I have to carry her. I'm saying, pardon me?
If the process goes on all the time, why do you need such frequency?
You need such frequency because the patient is unable to internalize you. It may go on with you to a degree. It doesn't go on with the person. There's demonic forces that lurk here, Bill. There's demonic forces that want to kill that link. That's the point. You're always up against forces that want to kill the internalization process, forces that secretly lure the patient out of that field of intense dependency and vulnerability. So it goes over and over and over again.
Where are those forces?
Which ones?
The demonic ones. That want to break the link.
That want to break the link? Where do they come from? where does the dark side of God come from? That's the question. Do you want to reduce those forces to the result of infantile frustrations, as of course would commonly be done? I would not. I'd rather say that the prince of this world is a factor. Does exist. One can play all kinds of games with it, mind you. You can get into all kinds of energy schemas and talk about the importance of disorder and disordered states in order for ordered states to come into space-time. And you can even play with the second law of thermodynamics about the necessity of such chaotic states if you want to. But the fact is that they're there and they have an intense power.
Have you walked all the way out of this process with anyone yet? This level of process? Or is this...
This one I'm talking about is the deepest, and I haven't walked out of this yet. I've been through it, of course, in lots of different ways, but this is the deepest yet. Yeah, that's what I should have asked.
What?
That's what I should have asked. I assume you meant it finishing in some way to some good conclusion.
I'm with her until the time when she's able to be on her own again, which I assume is your own.
Of course. I would say that I have not, with this this woman that I've been talking about is the deepest yet. I think one does this in all different ways. And all, you know, and you always think you've gone deeply enough and walked out in your terms through it. But in this case, this is the deepest I've known of, where there is this link between these two levels and this intense level, you know, of regression. And here we're still on the way. Yeah.
given where we are in the 20th century, the age of reason.
This is the age of reason.
And the concomitant loss of spirituality. Do you see borderline as a phenomenon pretty much of the 20th century? Or it's become so in or prevalent lately.
I wrote about this a lot in my book on the borderline personality. I wrote about it somewhat, especially in the last chapter on the golden ass. Borderline states of mind have been in existence from eternity. If you want to take the Old Testament God Yahweh, you could diagnose Yahweh as a borderline personality. And you can find borderline states of mind in the earliest mystical practices. You can find them, for example, as a diagnosis of St. John of the Cross. It's not that borderline states of mind, of course, are anything new. But they definitely do come up any time there is a powerful need for a new incarnation, for a new dispensation, for a new spiritual awareness. No question. Yes?
In your relation with psychics, can we judge from what some of the teachers have told us that you sometimes take the development that they transfer in order to work out these things with the patient? I had understood that Jung, in general, did not favor transfer if it can be avoided. Of course, that's a big issue. Would you comment on this?
Yeah, we're going to not get on to stains. Look, there are processes in which the conscious awareness of transference is not useful, and in fact undermines the process. And there are others in which it is intensely necessary. I think that, you know, a lot's been written about Jung's ambivalence to the transference, and it's kind of not too fruitful, really. The point is that there are processes that absolutely, in my mind, will not thrive without an intense engagement in the transference, meaning an active, conscious engagement in ways in which patient and therapist psyche intertwine. Just to repeat myself, there are others not that way. For example, I had a process recently finished with a woman who came to me in a very, very bad state, who came to me in a after having been hospitalized twice in her life, only getting out of the hospital by putting back a false self, as is so often the case. A woman who had followed her husband around the world, he a naval officer, and she the dutiful wife, all the while trying to study theology. Wherever she went, she would take her theology courses. Eventually, she was able to divorce him. This is all in the course of analysis. This was a bad marriage. I know it was a bad marriage. She divorced him, and she became a quite remarkable theologian, getting her doctorate from Yale University. She worked with me for many years in very, very distressed states of mind. Early in the analysis, she would sometimes be under a table in my waiting room for 3 hours after every session, crawled up in a fetal position. Very difficult level she had to go to. She knows my work. She reads my work. When she left, she sent me a letter. And she said in the letter that she wondered if I wasn't disappointed in her, that we had never really engaged a subtle body realm in which we had created this subtle body through a conjunctio between us. But she said, instead, I think what we've done is both of us together individually have combined to create a church. You get the difference? A radical difference. I think it's a beautiful difference. One doesn't have to have a process in which psyches combine in a very felt way where the interactive space is enlivened and everything that the alchemical model often points to. One can have processes in which one intentionally even averts one's eyes from the energies that might create that process. Intentionally. This woman was a terrible victim of sexual abuse. Intentionally averts one's eyes. By the way, that's a terrible common story. You know, we thought that was the odd part. Nowadays, the statistics that way are horrendous, the amount of sexual abuse. But it was important for me to never see that level because it too energized her. She became too overwhelmed by kind of a Dionysian fury that led to too serious a regression. So instead, my work with her was one of seeing a child hidden in a forest, looking at it, watching it peek out at me, and intentionally not dealing with the erotic energies that were at hand. So that's what I mean. When you talk about, does one always need a transference? Sometimes you absolutely don't want a transference to come into the picture and be conscious. Sometimes it can be poison. When Jung says, for one time, sometimes it's a poison and sometimes it's a cure, people take that and they've written about Jung's view of the transference as having to do with his ambivalence towards it, as having to do with his problem with Freud. I'd much rather say otherwise. I'd rather say he knew what he was talking about. Okay? Yeah?
Is it through alchemy that you have been able to work at this level? I don't think there are very many analysts that have, for want of a better word, the courage to do that.
Well, it's definitely alchemy for me that allows this level to be a workshop, that allows this level to be a place where I go to do my experiments like a mad scientist. You know, I'm interested in this level. I'm interested in the way it works. If I didn't have that point of view, I couldn't do this, whatever that says about me. I couldn't do it without that point of view. Yeah. How come? Our stains. We'll go on now. I'm going to read to you, okay? Not a lot, but you can take some reading. You know? This is a text that's early alchemy, second century, second to first century. Bolos Democritus, who is the talked of as the founder, this is what the text says. Bolos Democritus tells us that he came to Egypt to teach the lore of occult virtues, so that you might rise above multiple curiosity and multiple diffused curiosities. He recounts how he learned these things from the master named Astaines. And here's what he says. After learning these things from the master named Astaines, certain things, and aware of the diversity of the matter, I set myself to make the combination of natures. But as our master died before our initiation was completed, and we were still all taken up in learning the matter, it was from Hades, as one says, that I tried to evoke him. I applied myself to the task, and as soon as he appeared, I apostrophized him, I apostrophized him. That means speaking to someone who's not there, like someone from the dead. I apostrophized him in these terms. Are you going to give me nothing in return for what I've done for you? Bad act of imagination. I spoke in vain. He kept silent. However, when I addressed him as well I could and asked him how I should combine the natures, he told me that it was difficult for him to speak. The diamond wouldn't allow it. He said only, the books are in the temple. Turning back, I then went to make searches in the temple on the chance of being able to lay my hands on the books. But despite all of our searching, a group, all of our searching, we found nothing. And so we gave ourselves a terrible lot of trouble in trying to learn how substances and natures were united and combined in a single substance. Well, when we realized the synthesis of the matter, some time passed by and a festival was held in a temple. We took part, all of us, in a banquet. Then, as we were in the temple, all of a sudden a column of its own accord opened up in the middle. But at first glance, there seemed nothing inside. However, the son of Astaines told us that it was in this column that his father's sacred books had been placed. And, taking charge of the situation, he brought the thing out into the open. But when we bent to look, we saw in surprise that nothing had escaped us in our previous studies. Nothing had escaped us except this wholly valuable formula which we found there. A nature is delighted by another nature. A nature conquers another nature. A nature dominates another nature. Great was our admiration for the way he had concentrated in a few words all of the scripture. Now, this triadic formula of Astaines is a crucial formula that runs throughout all of alchemy. And I want to give you some attitudes towards it. But first, if I may, I want to read to you something from Jack Lindsay, his discussion of that formula, because it's really crystallizes things in a beautiful way. The change in quality of an object was also a change in its inner organization and was linked or identified with color changes. Lead, a primary common metal, had to be broken up, changed, driven up the scale towards silver or gold. It had to change its color. So fire was invoked, and under its action, the lead was reduced to a fluid state. The lead was first reduced to a fluid state. The fluidity thus brought about was what constituted the primary level in which new potentialities were actively present. Also, the liquefaction of lead involved its blackening. Please hear the metaphor of psyche through this. So the blackness of the liquid condition above all expressed the attainment of a primary level, a state of chaos. Having produced chaos, the alchemist was in a position to act the role of demiurge and drive matter up its hierarchical level with gold as the highest step. To bring about this upward movement, the principle of sympathy or attraction was invoked. Somehow, the primary black had to be transformed into white or yellow, which expressed the nobler metals. This could be done, it was believed. This could be done, it was believed. If one could find a metal which had certain affinities with both the lower and higher substances, which sympathized with both of them, and which exerted its attractive power in both directions, downwards and upwards. By using the right kind of metal in the right kind of proportions, one can swing the balance towards the upper levels and thus transform the material into the higher. The principle of this operation was expressed in the famous triadic formula of Eustain's, which Bolos Democritus discovered. The two materials, that of primary matter or liquid blackness, and that of the alloying and transforming addition, must have something in common, some element of harmony. That is, they delighted in one another. But if that were all, a state of equilibrium was created and nothing happened. The first level was not transcended. So one nature must conquer the other. That's the second step. The conquering act was the moment of transformation when the equilibrium was broken and a new relationship established. The new fused substance existed at a higher level and involved the creation of a new quality, which revealed itself in the color change. But that was not enough. The new state must be stabilized so that it might provide the basis for yet another upward movement. Hence the third section of the formula, one nature must dominate another nature. The three stages of the alchemical act might then be defined: mixture on the original level, introduction of a dynamic factor which changes the original relations and creates a new qualitative level, then stabilization of this level. Now, to speak about that in terms of two people together. Nature delights in another nature. Jung says the transference is based on mutual unconsciousness. Your unconsciousness and the patient's unconsciousness are the similar natures. It is when you are aware of your unconsciousness and the way it mirrors the patient's is in a way identical to the patient, that you both suffer from the same states of unconsciousness. Mutual unconsciousness, that is a basic similarity of natures. Nature delights in nature. When you know, consequently, that you and your patient are in some way the same, not where you see you're different, but where you see that you're the same, you've reached a level where a nature can delight in a nature. That is to say, your awareness of your states of mind, in which, for example, you are overwhelmed, states of mind in which you tend to be in chaos, how those states of mind link to your patients. Clearly, you must have more control over them than your patient does, or else the process can't work. The patient's process and yours are like you being the alloying agent and the patient's being the material to be worked on. Your capacity to be the agent that can go above and below, that can work the process in terms of a sublimation and a coagulation, of an ascent and a descent, as we talked about, your ability, in other words, to play with the material at hand, puts you in the position of the alloying agent. Winnicott said all of psychotherapy is about teaching somebody to play. your capacity to move your psyche that way puts you in that position. The thing you can create such that a nature overcomes a nature, in other words, a third thing is formed, the conjunctio is the second step. The last step, a nature dominates a nature, would be a step in which that state of union is totally, totally stabilized and never dies. Clearly something no one attains in a lifetime. One attains a union state frequently, which then dies, creates a nigredo, brings in more material, more need to see the mutual unconsciousness, so natures can combine again, more union states, etc., etc. The formula also is taken from the dyeing industry in Egypt, the dyeing of fabrics. It's never possible to dye a fabric and attain a total color-fast fabric. There's always some bleeding. The attempt also is then consequently connected with craft industries, as alchemy was intimately connected with the craft industries, with metallurgy, and with the uses of plant juices for the sake of hallucinogenic purposes or dyeing purposes or tinting, you know, metals. All of these were combined. But this is the kind of qualitative logic that the alchemists involved with. States of mind in which there's a combination of natures, in which a new nature is formed, and in which there's a groping and moving towards stability of the natures. In pictures I'll show you, and I will run through these quickly because I'm sure some of you have seen them, and I intended to talk about the Splendor Solace today, but I will run through the Rosarium Philosophorum and show you how these states of Ostein's formula have to do show up in the Rosarium, with the final picture of the Rosarium, picture 20, being the Corpus Glorificatum, the risen Christ who transcends finally death and has passion too, as representative of a state where a nature overcomes, dominates the process, and leads to total stability. Yeah?
Just brings me back to a question I had last night. It sounds as if these conjunctios that you're talking about, and with your case description last night of the series of them, that there is a quality to them, that they have a kind of an archetypal flavoring or base to them, which can be different given the circumstance of the time, that the new elements that are kind of forming, there isn't this kind of absolute conjunctio, but there's a kind of a specialness in each one.
That's right. There's a specialness in each one. Different qualities will be contained in each one. There'll be a mixture of personal and archetypal dynamics in each one. They will always be different. But one is dealing with remarkable capacities of psyche in which qualities combine in a state in which energy is released and in which new structure is released. Now, another way... tell me if I'm overfeeding you. Another way of looking at this formula is in terms of Melanie Klein's notion of the depressive position. Melanie Klein taught the following ideas, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, that in development, the infant moves from a stage which she called the paranoid schizoid position into a stage called the depressive position. In the paranoid schizoid position, the mother is not a single mother. There are two mothers. As a metaphor, there is a good breast and a bad breast. When the child is in intense distress, the so-called bad breast is the mother and dominates. The distress can come from the environmental factors, The distress can come from internal factors, from hunger. The child can't differentiate inner from outer very well. Under that distress, it requires a ministering figure, the good mother, to relieve that distress by detoxifying the infant through reverie and through actual feeding and holding. Then the mother becomes the good mother. But there are two mothers, not one, two. The depressive position is initiated by a natural movement. Klein thought it was at 3 to 4 months of age. Some now think it's 8 to 9 months of age. It's always happening. But nevertheless, of a natural movement where those two mothers combine into a single object. The child is then in a terrifying position. That's the inception, the movement into the depressive position, as she called it. Because now, the child's vicious, violent attacks on the bad breast, the breast that was the object of extreme distress previously, now becomes a terrifying situation because these attacks now threaten to destroy the good breast as well, because good and bad have combined. Somehow the child has to get through that position. Now, a nature delights in another nature. The breast, the good and the bad breast have combined. Now that has to be stabilized on a higher level into a single object. Okay? This is the state of mind that borderline patients have never gotten through. This is the sector in everybody in which there is good-bad splitting, in which there is a good and a bad person, in which your object relations, so to speak, are not whole. But one has to be able to get from that stage of splitting, good-bad splitting, paranoid behavior, schizoid withdrawal, into a stage where those two combine into a whole object, so that another nature is formed. A nature dominates the previous nature. How does one get to that form? What is the dynamic relationship that helps that happen? The best conceptualization of that, I think, comes from Winnicott. Winnicott says, speaking for the baby, "I love you because I killed you. I killed you in fantasy and you kept living. And I continued to kill you and you survived. And that's why I love you." The alloying substance, the analyst, the mother, the husband, the wife, has to be able to be in that position to survive the intense fantasized attacks without being killed. That's the worry that you worried about, where patients worry, are you going to change? The other way to recognize that is what the patient is terrified of, is the aggression going to kill you? Are you going to be able to remain a self while you're under this attack? Are you going to be able to be subject to exceptional abuse, attack, which often sees clearly into your weaknesses and failings? And are you going to be able to remain an embodied self while that happens, or are you going to become defensive, split, counterattack, withdraw, whatever? All statements, unconscious, conscious statements to the patient, which would say you have not survived. In the process of surviving that attack, one can help the patient, just like the mother can help the infant, move into the so-called depressive position, in which there is a mourning. There is a mourning because there is a terror and a fear that the attacks have indeed killed you. There is a mourning, a pining, but at the same time an awareness that you haven't been killed. And in that process, a new nature is created. Does that ever become stabilized? Do we ever always have whole object relations? Find me that person, and I'll make him my guru, or her my guru. Of course not. In the Kleinian idea, Klein kind of bungled her theory a bit with a heavy moralistic bias, which reckoned the depressive position superior morally over the paranoid schizoid position, because in the depressive position, one does, in fact, begin to learn concern. Winnicott talks about a stage of ruth, concern, instead of ruthlessness of the previous position. You will often see with people, and of course with yourselves, areas of your being or their being in which intense ruthlessness dominates, in which there is absolutely no concern for another person. Sometimes you see this in the worst with mothers and children, when the mother is just overwhelmed and doesn't have enough support in her environment. Tremendous states of ruthlessness can dominate. What's a greater example of ruthlessness than sexual abuse? You know, all coming out of areas of massive ruthlessness of the personality. So it's not for nothing that Klein had a moral bias towards the depressive position. But this depressive position was seen by others, especially Bion, to really not be an end result, but in fact to be a kind of container. A nature dominates another nature, a container that in turn had to be destroyed because it was too small. And what was it destroyed by? It was destroyed by the return of the so-called paranoid schizoid position, just like alchemy.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.